All right, let's get right into it. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling an industry that impacts literally every part of our lives, often without us even realizing it. We've pulled together an incredible stack of sources, deep industry reports, some fascinating historical accounts, and our mission is simple, really, to slice through the complexity and give you a lightning-fast understanding of the colossal, constantly evolving world of oil and gas. We'll explore its surprising roots, the intricate global dance of supply and demand, and why it remains absolutely vital even as the world pushes towards new energy sources.
What's truly fascinating here is just how deeply embedded this industry is. I mean, not merely in our daily consumption habits, but in areas as critical as national security, global geopolitics, and even, election outcomes. The prices of crude oil and natural gas are, in fact, two of the most intensely watched commodity prices on the planet.
Yeah, you see those numbers everywhere.
Exactly. And we've seen immense rapid change recently from the explosion of U.S. production and sanctions on major players like Russia and Iran to massive new discoveries in places like Guyana and East Africa, and of course the ongoing pretty heated global debate about climate change. Yet our sources predict global energy demand will jump by a staggering 20% by 2040.
Wow, 20%.
20%. So it's abundantly clear this isn't just a historical topic, it's a crucial lens through which to view our present and our future.
That forecast alone, a 20% jump, is a powerful reminder of this industry's enduring relevance. But before we get ahead of ourselves, it's easy to assume the U.S. was the birthplace of oil, right? Given its industrial might.
Mm-hmm.
However, our sources tell a different, much older story. Can you take us back to the very beginning, like where it all truly started?
Indeed. And it's a common misconception. The first modern oil well wasn't in Pennsylvania, actually. It was in the Baku region of Azerbaijan in 1843, back when it was part of the Russian Empire.
1843, way earlier than I thought.
Yeah, predates the U.S. discovery by over a decade. In fact, by 1901, Baku alone was producing half of the entire world's oil supply.
Half the world's oil. From one place.
Pretty amazing, right? The U.S. industry did, of course, kick off in a big way with Colonel Edwin Drake in Pennsylvania in 1859. And this early American period saw the rise of industrial titans like John D. Rockefeller. When he famously created the Standard Oil Trust in 1882, he wasn't just forming a monopoly. I mean, he already controlled an astonishing 90% of the kerosene market.
90%? Just incredible dominance.
It really was. But his real genius, as historian Alfred Chandler pointed out, was achieving massive economies of scale by combining all refining operations under a single streamlined management structure. This move, Chandler argued, fundamentally set the stage for the dynamic logic of growth and competition that drives modern capitalism. So the key insight here isn't just market control, it's about industrial efficiency on a scale never seen before.
That's a remarkable way to look at Rockefeller's strategy, optimizing the whole process, not just cornering the market. And it sounds like there was another sort of pivotal moment that completely changed how oil was actually used globally.
Absolutely. The Spindletop discovery in East Texas in 1901, that was nothing short of a game changer. Before Spindletop, oil was primarily valued for, lamps and lubrication, simple stuff. Afterward, almost overnight, it became the essential fuel for these brand new inventions that would define the 20th century, the airplane and the automobile.
Right. The internal combustion engine changes everything.
Exactly. And ships and trains also began a swift conversion from coal to oil. So for the next century, oil, and subsequently natural gas, they basically solidified their position as the world's most critical energy sources, drove everything.
So with oil suddenly becoming so indispensable, it's natural to assume there would be widespread concerns about it running out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've certainly heard the phrase peak oil thrown around quite a bit over the years.
Oh, yeah. Peak oil is a concept that has, it's kind of haunted the industry since its early days. In 1950, for instance, the U.S. Geological Survey estimated there were roughly 1 trillion barrels of conventional recoverable resources globally. Fast forward 50 years to the year 2000, and that estimate had tripled to 3 trillion barrels.
Tripled? So much for running out back then.
Well, exactly. So the peak oil theory, famously popularized by M. King Hubbert, suggests the sort of terminal decline after a peak in production. But our sources consistently highlight the immense complexity here. It's not that straightforward. As one article in Science put it, kind of poetically, although hydrocarbon resources are irrefutably finite, no one knows just how finite. It's incredibly difficult to estimate oil trapped in porous rocks thousands of feet below ground, right? And our knowledge of these reservoirs actually increases as they are exploited. We learn more as we go. They even caution against crying wolf, suggesting it perpetuates a misguided obsession with oil security rather than fostering actual understanding.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, the real takeaway is that it's not simply a fixed, countable amount that will just poof, vanish one day. Instead, the very definition of what constitutes a reserve is constantly in flux. Is that right? What does this mean for how we should perceive oil availability in the long run?
Precisely. You've got it. It means true reserves are a dynamic interplay of technology, price, and politics. It's a moving target. When prices rise significantly, resources once considered completely non-economic, like the vast oil sands of Alberta, Canada, suddenly become feasible to extract.
The oil sands. Good example.
Yeah, for decades, Alberta's oil sands weren't even considered real reserves by many. Too expensive, too difficult. Until, you know, a combination of rising global prices and incredible technological innovation made them economically viable. Now, they're often cited as holding the second largest potential recoverable oil reserves on Earth, behind only Saudi Arabia.
Second largest. Wow.
Yeah. It perfectly illustrates how price and technological advancement constantly redefine what we consider an available reserve. It's less about a dwindling supply and more about changing access and economics.
That Alberta example is fantastic. Really drives the point home. It's almost like the goalposts keep moving.
Uh-huh.
And speaking of prices, this industry seems almost synonymous with dramatic ups and downs, these cycles. How do they impact its overall health?
Oh, the cycles are brutal. The oil and gas industry has always been cyclical, often violently so. Think back to the 1970s with the Arab oil embargo and events in Iran and Iraq. Prices went through the roof. But that was followed by a really long period of low prices from about 1985 to 1998.
Right. I remember gas being cheap then.
Yeah.
Relatively.
Exactly. Then prices surged again after 9/11, dipped during the 2008 recession, then soared to over $100 a barrel until 2014, before falling off a cliff again. This extreme volatility directly impacts profitability, massively. While the industry is often criticized for generating immense profits, which it does sometimes, its long-term profitability isn't actually much higher than the average across many other sectors.
That's surprising.
It is. As former ExxonMobil CEO Lee Raymond famously quipped back in 2005 during a high price cycle, he said he didn't recall anyone asking if they'd have enough money to invest when prices were just $10 a barrel a mere 7 years prior.
Good point.
Yeah. And the S&P 500 energy sector even lagged the broader S&P 500 after 2014 for a while. It shows that the public perception of constant guaranteed high profits can be, well, pretty misleading. It's feast or famine, but often the public only sees the feast.
That context really challenges the common narrative, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It sounds like a high-stakes roller coaster business for sure. Okay, so this industry is clearly massive and global, but how does crude oil or natural gas actually get from deep underground to, say, our homes and cars? What does that intricate value chain actually look like? Can you break that down a bit?
Sure. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the industry is logically segmented into three core activities: upstream, midstream, and downstream. Each bit has its own unique challenges and, frankly, incredible innovations.
Okay, upstream first.
Right. Upstream is all about exploration, development, and production, basically. Finding the oil and gas and getting it out of the ground. This is where companies negotiate incredibly complex deals with governments because most oil ownership globally is state sovereign.
Governments own most of it, not companies.
That's right, in terms of what's in the ground. What's truly fascinating is how technology has drastically improved success rates here. Well, completion rates, which hovered around maybe 65% after World War II, are now much, much higher thanks to innovations like advanced seismic imaging. A critical skill here is reservoir management. It's not just about finding new oil, but efficiently managing existing fields to maximize recovery.
Makes sense. Get the most out of what you found.
Exactly. And measuring proved reserves, that's the amount reasonably certain to recover under existing economic and operating conditions, is incredibly complex. Our sources call them an approximation about formations thousands and even tens of thousands of feet below ground. It's a blend of geology, engineering, expert interpretation, and, crucially, economics.
So not an exact science, then.
Far from it. And here's a surprising twist. Under certain production sharing agreements, when the price of oil goes up, proved reserves can actually go down.
Wait, how does that work? Higher price, lower reserves.
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive, right? But if the government's share of the profit oil increases significantly with price, the company might be entitled to physically lift fewer barrels to recover its costs and agreed profit. So its booked reserves decrease. The intense pressure to continuously book reserves has even led to major scandals, like Shell overstating its reserves by nearly 25% back in 2004.
Wow, 25%, that's huge. Shows the pressure.
It really does. Even in an industry built on hard science, the numbers can be surprisingly fluid.
Okay, so that's upstream finding and extracting with lots of complexity around reserves.
Yeah.
So once it's out of the ground, what's the next stage?
That moves us to midstream. This covers storing, trading, and transporting crude oil and natural gas. Crude oil, you know, in its raw state, has little value until it's refined. So transporting it involves vast networks of pipelines, massive ships, barges, and we've even seen a resurgence in rail transport, especially in places like North Dakota and Alberta, where production boomed faster than pipeline capacity could keep up.
Right, getting it from the wellhead to the refinery or the port.
Exactly. And pipelines, while incredibly efficient, are often fraught with geopolitical challenges. They cross national borders, frequently becoming bargaining chips in international relations, and are sadly targets for sabotage and theft in some regions, particularly in places like Nigeria and Iraq.
Yeah, you hear about that. So that's midstream. What about downstream?
Downstream is all about refining and marketing. Refineries turn crude into the products we actually use, like gasoline, which makes up about 60% of refinery product volume in the U.S., plus diesel, jet fuel, heating oil, asphalt, stuff like that. The profitability here is driven by the refining margin, or crack spread, basically the difference between crude oil prices and refined product prices.
The crack spread, okay.
Yeah, it sounds technical, but it's just that price difference. And this margin is notoriously volatile because crude and product prices fluctuate independently. Refiners often feel sort of squeezed between these two commodity markets. It led a Shell executive years ago to describe the refining business as grubbing for pennies.
Grubbing for pennies doesn't sound glamorous.
Not always, no. It can be very tough.
Okay, so given those complexities, it makes me wonder about natural gas. Is its journey from wellhead to consumer as challenging, or is it a completely different beast?
Natural gas is indeed a very different beast entirely. For many years, it remained a relatively niche product. Because unlike crude, it's not easily transportable without extensive pipeline networks, like the impressive 285,000 miles we have here in the U.S.
Right, it's a gas, harder to ship.
Exactly. But the growth of liquefied natural gas, or LNG, has been a true game changer, a massive one. LNG is natural gas cooled down to an astonishing negative 259 degrees Fahrenheit, or negative 162 Celsius. This turns it into a liquid, shrinking its volume drastically, making it transportable by specialized cryogenic vessels, basically giant thermos ships.
Minus 259 degrees, that's incredibly cold.
It is. And this technology has transformed LNG from a regional commodity into a vital part of the global energy business. It allows gas from remote offshore deposits or places without pipelines to reach distant markets. The U.S., for instance, went from being anticipated as a major LNG importer back in 2003 to a major exporter today, largely thanks to the shale gas revolution. Huge shift.
That is a huge shift, and natural gas is often talked about differently from oil, right? In terms of environment.
Yes, it's also increasingly seen as a crucial bridge fuel because it burns significantly cleaner than coal, especially in power generation, as the world transitions towards renewables.
Okay, bridge fuel. Got it. And finally, beyond direct energy, there's another crucial, often unseen output from this value chain that's absolutely vital to our modern lives, isn't there?
Indeed. The furthest downstream activity is petrochemicals. These are the organic chemical products derived from oil and gas feedstocks, things like ethane, propane, naphtha. They form the building blocks for literally thousands of everyday items. Think plastics, fertilizers, pharmaceuticals, synthetic fabrics, even ingredients in your shampoo and cosmetics.
Right, plastics especially. They're everywhere.
Everywhere. Major integrated oil companies like ExxonMobil are deeply involved, producing both high-volume commodity products and highly specialized chemicals. It's a very capital-intensive sector, and we're seeing new players in the Middle East and Asia, like SABIC and Sinopec, becoming increasingly prominent, really shifting the global landscape of chemical production.
That's a mind-boggling scale of interconnectedness, from fuel to plastics. It sounds like this entire landscape is dominated by, well, a few massive companies and governments. Can you shed some light on the key players and their very distinct motivations? Who runs the show?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. The industry is fundamentally shaped by two types of dominant players. You have the integrated oil companies, IOCs, often called the oil majors. Think ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, Chevron, Total Energies. And then increasingly, you have the national oil companies, NOCs.
Okay, IOCs and NOCs, how are they different?
Well, IOCs, being publicly traded companies, are primarily driven by shareholder maximization. Their main goal is wealth creation, cost control, financial performance. They tend to take a pragmatic, long-term view, recognizing cycles and uncertainty as just inherent parts of doing business in this sector. NOCs, however, are a completely different story. They are state-controlled or wholly state-owned. And critically, this is the big number. They control about 90% of the world's proven oil and gas reserves.
90%? Control over 90%? That's an incredible amount of leverage.
It's huge. It gives them immense power and often a broader mandate than just profit. They might be focused on national revenue, energy security, job creation, social programs.
Okay, so with that kind of state backing and control over reserves, my immediate thought is, are these giants always run efficiently, or do those other priorities sometimes get in the way?
That's a very perceptive question, and the reality is quite mixed based on our sources. Some NOCs have historically been described as, well, bloated and inefficient bureaucracies, often acting primarily as cash cows for governments. For example, Pertamina, Indonesia's NOC, reportedly awarded 159 contracts to companies linked to President Suharto's family without formal bidding.
Not ideal.
Not ideal, no. Venezuela's PDVSA, once a highly professional organization, became virtually indistinguishable from the government after Hugo Chavez took power. It lost about two-thirds of its staff, and its investment budget was heavily diverted to social programs. Production plummeted as a result, from 2.9 million barrels a day in 1998 to less than 1 million by 2019.
Wow, what a decline.
Massive decline. And Mexico's Pemex, due to years of underinvestment and the government's heavy reliance on it for revenue, saw production at its giant Cantarell field, once a submergent, plummet from over 2 million barrels a day down to just 161,000. This whole phenomenon is often linked to the resource curse.
The resource curse, right. Where having the resource paradoxically hurts the broader economy.
Exactly. Countries rich in natural resources paradoxically sometimes have lower economic growth and living standards due to an over-reliance on that single sector. When prices inevitably fall, as they always do, these countries can face severe economic challenges. Like Russia experienced a 4% GDP drop in 2015 when oil prices collapsed.
That's a stark picture of the resource curse. But right. Is it truly an inevitable outcome for state-owned companies? Or are there examples where NOCs have managed to overcome those inherent challenges and operate effectively, maybe even transparently?
Absolutely not inevitable. Not all NOCs fit that negative mold at all. Statoil of Norway, now called Equinor, is widely considered among the best-run and most transparent NOCs globally. Brazil's Petrobras, despite facing a major corruption scandal later on, developed world-leading technology in deep-water drilling, and at one point had a market capitalization rivaling some of the big IOCs. Malaysia's Petronas is also consistently seen as a well-managed, forward-looking entity.
So there are successful models out there.
Definitely. However, there's a telling quote from the chairman of Italy's Eni, another major player. He once commented that Western oil firms are like addicts in denial, struggling to access their own basic product oil because the NOCs control so much of the reserves. And even more tellingly, the best NOCs are now beginning to compete head-to-head with the oil majors beyond their own borders, investing internationally.
Ah, so they're expanding their reach now, too.
Yeah, they're becoming global players in their own right. It signals a massive ongoing shift in the industry's power structure.
That is a huge shift in the global energy landscape. Fascinating power dynamics. It's clear this industry is incredibly dynamic. So what role does innovation continue to play? Where are we seeing the most exciting new frontiers emerging?
Innovation is constant. It has to be. Across the entire value chain. In the upstream, finding and producing, we've seen astounding advancements like 3D seismic data that drastically reduces drilling risk. You can see underground much better. And directional and horizontal drilling techniques that allow companies to steer drill bits for miles underground, unlocking vast production, especially crucial for accessing unconventional resources.
Like shale oil and gas.
Exactly. In refining, nanotechnology is even being used to tailor catalysts for greater efficiency. Tiny tech making a big difference. But one of the biggest recent shifts, undoubtedly, is the exponential growth of unconventional oil and gas production, particularly in U.S. basins like the Permian in Texas, the Bakken in North Dakota, and the Marcellus Shale in the Appalachians. Technologies like hydraulic fracturing or fracking, combined with horizontal drilling, have unlocked vast resources previously considered completely inaccessible or uneconomic.
Right. The shale boom totally changed the U.S. energy picture.
Completely reshaped it. And global global energy markets, too.
And beyond these technological shifts in places like the U.S., who are the emerging global players shaping this future, where's the new demand coming from?
Well, what's truly fascinating here is the aggressive entry of countries like China and India into the global energy arena. They're huge drivers now. China, for instance, became a net oil importer back in 1998, and by 2013, it was the world's largest importer. By 2030, it's projected to import a staggering 80% of its oil needs.
80%.
Yeah. So Chinese companies, often NOCs themselves, are aggressively investing globally to secure supplies. And notably, sometimes without the geopolitical or ethical qualms that often limit Western companies from investing in certain places like Sudan or Iran in the past, India, now the third largest oil consumer, is also pouring investment into its domestic companies like ONGC and Oil India Limited. They're aiming to feed a rapidly industrializing economy and a population that will soon be, or maybe already is, the world's largest. These two countries are pivotal forces.
So, with all these new unconventional sources and these massive new players driving demand, are we seeing a fundamental shift in the conversation about alternative fuels? Or is the old guard, oil and gas, still holding strong?
It's a mix, really. There's undeniably significant investment and rapidly growing interest in alternative fuels. That's clear. Driven by both rising fossil fuel prices at times and, critically, climate change concerns. However, our sources make it unequivocally clear. Hydrocarbons, oil, and natural gas will continue to be the world's primary energy source for many years to come. The transition takes time.
Still dominant for the foreseeable future, then.
Seems that way. Looking ahead, some predictions feel fairly safe based on the data. Demand will certainly continue to rise in emerging markets like China and India, while likely flattening or even declining in developed economies like the U.S. and Europe due to efficiency and alternatives. NOCs will continue to expand their influence globally. Finding new conventional sources will get harder and more expensive. And unconventional production, like shale, will likely continue to grow its share of the market.
So the landscape keeps changing.
Constantly. But ultimately, oil and gas firms, especially the big IOC majors, will likely do what they've done for over a century. Take a long-term view, invest for the future despite the cycles, relentlessly push technological boundaries, and seek new resources and markets globally, adapting every step of the way. They're survivors.
That was an incredible deep dive. Seriously fascinating. An industry that truly defines so much of our modern world. From its surprisingly early beginnings way back in Azerbaijan, to the complex geopolitics and, frankly, the technological marvels of today. It's a story of constant evolution and just immense, undeniable impact.
Indeed. I think what truly stands out from all our sources is that, you know, even with all the important talk of energy transition, oil and gas remain indispensable. For now, and likely for a while, the intricate dance between technology, economics, and politics will absolutely continue to shape how we power our world for decades to come.
Absolutely. So for you, our listener, here's maybe a final thought to mull over as we wrap up. Considering that predicted 20% increase in global energy demand by 2040, how will this delicate shifting balance between the dominant national oil companies, the adaptable international oil companies, and the accelerating development of unconventional resources? How will all that truly redefine global power dynamics and energy security in the coming decades? Something to think about. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep digging for those insights.